Game on, weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Big thanks to Beto Da Silva for driving us through the afternoon. It's Monday the 19th of August and you're listening to Game On with me, Ruby Walsh. Coming up between now and the new music show at 7 o'clock, Alan Cawley will join us to review the opening weekend of the Premier League season, and we'll hear from Spurs ahead of their opening match in Leicester tonight. In golf, the FedEx Cup run-in is heating up on the PGA Tour, and we'll see how the Irish fared with Brian Keogh. Plus in cycling, La Vuelta is well underway. Shane Stokes will bring us up to speed and Dan Martin will tell us how to survive and thrive on a Grand Tour. If you want to have your say, you can send us a text on 51552 or you can contact us on WhatsApp at 087 187 9200 and we're on X at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
So welcome to Game on this not so nice Monday evening, but there is some breaking news in sport, and I'm delighted to say that Damien Lawler has joined us on the line. Damien, what's going on in the world of GAA football?
Mickey Hart's moving, Ruby. He's going to Offaly as joint manager on a 3-year term. The news, well, we got it confirmed earlier this evening, but it was just released not so long ago as well by the Offaly County Board, and it's... I suppose it's a seismic enough development in the Gaelic football landscape, Ruby. A man of Mickey Hart's stature joining Offaly. And I just think that a few weeks ago, Mickey Hart had said that he had no intention of leaving the intercounty stage. A lot of people maybe speculated that his next port of call might have been a bit closer. But it's Offaly, and he's chosen that now. And that's all been confirmed by ourselves and by the Offaly County Board as well, obviously.
It's his second venture into Leinster football. He was with Louth in the past, of course, wasn't he?
Yeah. Look, I mean, he'll take Offaly with Declan Kelly on a 3-year term. Before that, Ruby, he had a few seasons with Louth. Got back-to-back promotions, brought them to a Leinster final. Totally, probably revolutionised the way that they approached their training and preparation. Totally, maybe changed the mindset of the players. Brought a standard in to maybe the degrees that maybe with Gavin Devlin's intensity as a coach, the players may not have witnessed previously. They said that they were really, really impressed with what they had. Had begun preparations for the new season before he left then and joined Derry. And, you know, that was a controversial move. It still remains that to this day. But he got the Derry people, a lot of them anyway, on side with a McKenna Cup and a National League title. And the year kind of fell apart for them. Soon after that, you know, the year didn't go to plan, certainly, and he stepped down. And then, I suppose, before that, 18 years with Tyrone, three All-Ireland titles, six Ulster titles, a National League, as many McKenna Cups as you want, Ruby. I think he won 12 in his time with the team. And, of course, a Trojan stalwart at minor and underage for Tyrone as well. So this will be his 23rd season managing consecutively at intercounty level. So, you know, you've got Davy Fitz in the hurling. Back since 1989, Davy's been involved in the intercounty game as a player, coach, selector or manager. But this will be Hart's 23rd season consecutively managing at intercounty level. That's quite a feat.
Oh, it's a life dedicated to the game, isn't it? So Davy's gone north, Mickey's coming south. Any other big rumblings going on in the GAA world then? Anybody else going to come from left field, no?
There's lots to come. As we speak, like, there's probably six or seven counties between hurling and football are probably in the midst or the throes of appointing new management. And Ruby as well, you know the Gaelic game set up to coaches. It's all about your coach now and your backroom team and indeed your S&C coach as well. So I think that, in terms of Offaly, they maintained their Division 3 status. They didn't have a great time over the Talton Cup, and I would say Hart will put a renewed focus maybe the moment he joins. You know, they will have, everybody will be just raising their standards. But look, he goes in with a good guy, Declan Kelly. Declan had a great, great time of Offaly under 20 manager, won the All-Ireland not so long ago too. And there is potential in Offaly. Like, a lot of the players are kind of stepping up. They're younger, but maybe two or three seasons, like the Lee Pearson coming through now. People were lamenting maybe the flattish start to the Premier League this weekend because the likes of Klopp and that working around. And you have Mickey Hart back now and you have Davy Fitz back. And, I mean, in terms of the profile of the games and in terms of adventurous and probably in terms of development progression for Antrim and Offaly, it's very exciting, Ruby. Watch this space at the very least, you know.
Oh, watch this space is right. Leinster hurling, Leinster football. They could both do the shot in the arm. So we're definitely watching this space. Damien Lawler, thank you so much for taking our call at such short notice. Alan Corley, you're in Sligo. You went all the way up for the FAI Cup match, didn't you, to see UCD beat Sligo Rovers?
I was hoping we could avoid that, Ruby. I'm still not over it.
We were never going to avoid that, Alan. As soon as our producer, Ronan Lawler, told me you were in Sligo, it was the first thing I was going to ask you about. What happened?
It's a good question what happened, Ruby. I'm not sure, and I'm still not sure John Russell knows or the players know, but I suppose on the other hand, you have to give UCD credit as well. And when you look at the teams that are left in the FAI Cup, it would have been a major, major opportunity for Sligo Rovers to go on and potentially get to maybe semi-final, final, or even lift the cup. And when you look at the form that they've been in, probably the form team in the league in the last 7-8 weeks, I think they've won 6 of their last 7 league games, so they would have fancied their chances strongly. I'm not sure if it was complacency that set in, but who knows, Ruby, and it's hard obviously to try and reflect on that and look back. I'm sure they're reviewing it, but they'll be so deeply, deeply disappointed because of the carrot that was dangling in front of them in terms of what was left. And no disrespect to the other teams, but you can look at the draw yourself. There's only really 2 of the big clubs left. Not big clubs, Bowes are a massive club and they're still left, but just 2 of the form clubs, if you like, because Bowes are obviously languishing 8th in the league, Drogheda are bottom of the table. It's Shelburne and Derry who are top of the table that are still left, and then your first division teams. So Sligo Rovers would have seen it as a major opportunity and they blew it.
It was the third round of the FA Cup and 16 have become 8, Alan. Derry beat Cork 1-0, but you're saying Shells are the form team. They need to go to penalties to beat Galway.
Today, but Galway, to be fair to them, are a tough nut to crack, Ruby. We've said that many times on the show. John Caulfield, Ollie Horgan, very experienced around the league, know the league inside out, and since they've come up from the first division, they've done very well and acquitted themselves really well in the Premier Division and going quite well mid-table, hovering around those European places. So it's been a really good return for them. And again, they would have fancied their chances of maybe progressing in the Cup. It was always going to be difficult going away to Talca Park. You mentioned that they did need penalties, but they got over the line, and that's all Damien Duff will be worried about because he knows Galway are a tough nut to crack. He is bigger fish to fry in terms of the league and where they want to be and want to win the league. But I think with the 8 teams that are left, and we've already discussed it there with themselves and Derry, both those teams will really, really be licking their lips now that if they get a favourable draw in the quarter-final, all of a sudden you find yourself in a semi-final and it's right up for grabs, the FAI Cup.
But Derry draw Shells, and it gets really interesting. Obviously, Drogheda hammered Wilton. Treaty beat Pike. Wexford beat Ballyfermot United. Athlone Town beat Waterford. Waterford had a red card, but still a big result for Athlone Town.
Massive result, yeah. And they deserve credit. But Ruby, I'm not sure if you've seen the video. I tweeted it out there over the weekend. Highly controversial. I know, you know, I'll send you the video.
But I might see it then.
Interestingly enough, it's actually been rescinded. I only looked 23 minutes ago and the FAI have rescinded the red card upon appeal from Waterford. But the problem with that, whilst it's the right decision to rescind it and Dara Lee should never have been sent off, it was a dreadful, dreadful decision, but they're still out of the cup. They can't rescind the result and get them back into the cup, and that's what cost them, because when they went down to 10 men, you have to give credit at loan, they still got the job done, but I would have fancied draw at 11-11, and when they took the lead as well at 1-0, you certainly would have fancied them. But once they had the man sent off, they were playing, I think, with 10 men for the guts of an hour and out, maybe 70 minutes. So it was always going to be a big ask. And they had one that went over the line as well that they felt they should have got rewarded a goal in the 94th minute, not given. So it was a bad night for the referee. It was a bad night for Waterford in terms of decisions. But to find themselves knocked out of the cup, and that'll be no consolation, Dara Lee's red card rescinded. But from Athlone's point of view, who've been going quite well in the first division, a massive result for them. They now find themselves one of those first division teams in the quarterfinal draw. And who knows, as you say, if they were to get a favourable draw, all of a sudden they might be in a semi-final. You mentioned the Shells draw Derry. I hope for the sake of the cup we don't see that and these two avoid each other until the final now, Ruby. And I'm not being selfish. I am being selfish saying that, because that's what we want. Shells and Derry, or Shells and Bowes, hopefully for the cup final.
I thought you were half a romantic in that, like, you know, a smaller team getting a big cup run. You know, what about these small clubs at?
Yeah, and it would be great for them, and it would be a great story. But I suppose just in terms of the spectacle itself, like since we've gone to the Aviva Stadium in the last 10, 12 years, and I've done the last 7 finals, and we've had fantastic occasions with huge crowds, and we keep upping the crowd and increasing the capacity up over, I think the last one was over 40,000, which was incredible. And no disrespect to a couple of those smaller clubs, but I just don't think we would see that if they were to get there. If they get there on merit, absolutely good luck to them, and the manager of whatever team that is and the players, absolutely good luck to them. But I just think in terms of us trying to grow the game here and the spectacle, I think we need to see a couple of the big clubs still in the final, and whether that be Bowes, even Drogheda maybe. But look, the cup is that's the beauty of the cup. Anything can happen, and it's a long time since we have seen a big surprise in it, Ruby. So maybe that might be a nice romantic storyline, as you say. But for me, I still want to see two of the big clubs and huge crowds and huge interest in the cup final, because it's our showpiece day where we get a Sunday afternoon for about 5 hours live coverage, and it's a fantastic day. Normally, like, no disrespect to a couple of those teams in the first division, but you just wouldn't get that.
I know what you mean, Alan. I was in the RDS yesterday afternoon for the Rolex Grand Prix, and what you wanted were the best riders in the final round and the entertainment that Martin Fuchs, Aaron Vale and Mark McCauley gave everybody who was in the RDS yesterday afternoon was incredible. So I understand exactly what you mean by having the big teams to entertain on the biggest stage. We usually start on Monday, Alan, with a sporting highlight. Did you have one, or were you too busy sulking over Rovers?
Still crying into me cornflakes, Ruby, but I do have one actually, and it's funny you touched on it there in the Gaelic chat with Damien about Mickey Hart going for 23 consecutive seasons as a manager. Well, my highlight is James Milner, 23 consecutive seasons playing in the Premier League, and he broke the record at the weekend. I think it was Ryan Giggs had the record. Absolutely phenomenal achievement. 38 years of age. I was at Leeds when he was a young fella starting off, and they had him earmarked for a big future. Maybe not as big a future as what we've seen and how well he's done, but to be competing and to be playing, turning out with some of the biggest clubs in the Premier League, Man City, Villa, Newcastle, Liverpool, now he's with Brighton. It's a phenomenal career that James Milner has had, and to be still doing it and still playing centre midfield on Saturday against Everton and getting a positive result, I just think it's an amazing achievement.
Well, it is incredible going. Luka Modric looks set to extend his 18-year international career as well after Croatia named him in their squad for the opening matches of this season's Nations League. So looks like soccer players are lasting longer and longer now, Alan.
And it is, and that's the thing, Ruby, you know yourself, the longevity in these sports people. I think that's what's makes greatness, really, is the ones that are doing it at the top year in, year out, for like the guts of 15, 20 years. You see it in the tennis with Djokovic. It's phenomenal to keep going. And not only to keep going, it's one thing to be competing, but to be still winning at that level and to be still at the top of your game, the likes of Modric, the likes of Milner in the Premier League, never dropped down the divisions, still holding his own at 38 years of age. And it's a credit to themselves. It's one thing to have talent, but it's a credit to themselves in terms of their professionalism, how well they look after themselves, recovery, all that kind of stuff that comes into it. I know the game is more professional now, and the sports science and the detail that they delve into and how well they're looked after. But there's still a serious amount of self-discipline and all that as well that you have to be doing yourself. And he's obviously doing it, Milner. I just think, I honestly, Ruby, when I look at players doing that for such a long period of time, it's unbelievable.
I get the feeling you're slightly like me in that little bit old-fashioned, in that you have admiration for James Milner, for a Luka Modric. What about Raheem Sterling and his carry-on at the weekend? Where would your admiration be for that?
Yeah, well, it's not the first time with him, and I'd actually have a little bit of sympathy for him in the sense that it's chaotic, Chelsea. Absolutely chaotic. I looked at a graphic yesterday, Ruby, right? And this new manager that's come in, Maresca, decent manager, done a good job at Leicester. Obviously, he worked under Ancelotti, he's worked under Guardiola, so a good pedigree. He's obviously trying to branch out by himself now, but he's walked into an absolute mess at Chelsea from top to bottom. And it's one thing trying to manage the egos of those 11 players that he's dealing with, and maybe 16 to 18 of a squad. He has 43 players on his books, Ruby. 43. I don't know how you even look, how you even contemplate where to start in managing that situation. It's there you go. Like, you know, it's one thing you could wake up today having to deal with the five or six that might be knocking on your door that didn't get a game yesterday. What about the other 12, 15 that are not even in the squad? And then there's another 10 added on to that that you're trying to get out the door and they don't want to leave. Like, it's just a headache after headache. And I actually think when you look at the team that they named yesterday, the 11 on paper is a very strong 11, a very good 11. If that was all that he has to contend with and deal with, I actually think he could do a really good job if he was just left to his own devices to to look after a squad of maybe 18 and try and put a shape and a formation on it. I actually think Chelsea could have a decent season, but having to manage upwards in terms of the owner and how chaotic things are with him, it's the fifth manager since he's been there, Todd Bowley. And then, as I say, the 43 players who were under their books on huge money, like Sterling's on 300 grand a week. He's not going to walk out the door to some club for 100 grand a week. So you're having to deal with him. Where do you put him? Sulking around the place. Couple of them being bad eggs. Like, it's a mess of a situation, and I don't envy that Maresca lad at all.
I don't envy him either. Look, Stephen Kelly thought last year that Chelsea would eventually, with the players they have, find their feet and get going. They didn't quite, but how did they start? They started yesterday afternoon against Man City. They got beaten 2-0. From my untrained eye, Alan, looking at it, they were second best.
Yeah, they were second best. Absolutely, they were second best. But you're playing against the best team we may have ever seen in the Premier League. And it's phenomenal. Like, we come to City, I'm sure, but even one little point on that you could allude to as to why Chelsea were second best. You look at the team that Man City named yesterday, and you go through all the teams, Ruby, this weekend, and the narrative around the weekend was how early the players are back after the Euros, and is it a wise move, and they're going to come into, I suppose, problems throughout the season in terms of fatigue, and are we flogging the players? And that's a bigger, wider discussion, which will no doubt rear its head at some point towards the middle part of the season, if not the end of the season. But you look at Man City, what they did yesterday. Walker, Stones, Foden and Rodri, they're four big boys, didn't have to name them in the team and still get a result away to Chelsea. All the other players in all the other teams, Saka at Arsenal, Declan Rice, all the other big boys in all the other clubs, they all had to play yesterday because the team needed them to play, and they don't have the squad depth, if you like, of a City that can afford to be still without four of their best players, four of the best players in Europe, and they still go to Chelsea with a really, really strong team and win. So it's no slight on Chelsea to be losing to Man City, especially in your first day out. But they were second best, absolutely. But I don't think you could judge them on that alone yesterday. I actually think they did okay in the game. And if you look at, I suppose, the 11 that he did name, Ruby, I think it's a strong 11. It's a decent 11. And if it's just that he has to work with and deal with, and the squad and trying to put a bit of shape on them, I think Chelsea could go okay in terms of maybe challenging for the top four or being in the top six or whatever and getting themselves back on some sort of right track that we've seen in recent seasons. But they're just way off Man City's level, as are so many. So I wouldn't kind of be too hard on them on that one.
The second best team last year, of course, were Arsenal. They kicked off against Wolves. Kai Havertz and Bukayo Saka gave them a 2-0 win. David Raya made a couple of good saves, but they kind of picked up where they left off.
Yeah, I thought they were very good. I watched the game Saturday, but I thought they were excellent, Arsenal, and played the way we've seen, as you said, where they left off, on the front foot, real aggressive, going after teams in the opening 15, 20 minutes, got the early goal, Havertz, managed the game up to that. You're right about the goalkeeper. He did have to pull off one good save, Raya, but when he was called upon, it was a really good save, kept it at 1-0, and then once Saka got the second, it was game over, really. I thought they were very good, very impressive. You're probably going to ask me, because you haven't asked me yet, because I wasn't chatting to you last week about a prediction and who's going to win the league, so I might as well tell you now while we're on it. I think Arsenal will win the league. I really fancy them. The trajectory that they've been on under Arteta over the last 2 years has obviously seen them get closer and closer to City, to the point where they're only 2 points off them last year, almost near perfect. You need to beat City, and Arsenal were, bar one result against Aston Villa after Christmas where they lost, up to that they were perfect, and after that they were perfect. So if they can maintain that, which I think they can, I think the signing of Calafiori is very, very strong. Bit of depth to the back four, which is also really strong. The best defence in the league. Raya, I think, is very good in goals. And going forward, Saka was electric on Saturday, Ruby. It's amazing when you think that he gets some criticism when he plays for England. He's phenomenal, Saka. I love him.
I could have swore about 4 minutes ago you told me, when we were talking about City and Man Chelsea, that City were probably the best team ever to play in the Premier League, and now you're telling me they're not even going to win it. Arsenal are going to beat them.
They probably are the best team to ever play in the league, and the results reflect that. Is it 6 and 7 Premier Leagues? When we look back in time, they will be known as that. But I do think Arsenal have it in them to get, just, I suppose, tipped them this year, and they've come so close. I'm just not sure if they are amazing, City, and you look at them yesterday, they are like a machine, and we already touched on the players that have been left out, and the squad depth is just phenomenal that they can still name such a strong team and get the job done as comprehensively as they did yesterday. But I just think Arsenal are very, very close to them, Ruby, and it might only be the difference in one result that gets them over the line this year, because they've pushed them so close now. But that's the challenge for Arsenal. Can they maintain that form that we've seen over the last couple of seasons that has brought them so close? I think they can. I might be wrong, but I think they can. And I think he's done a great job, Arteta. He deserves a lot of credit since he's gone in there. And I don't think anyone else can get near City, only Arsenal. I think there's a gap then when we, even though I was impressed with Liverpool on Saturday, I thought they played very well in the second half against Ipswich. I do think there's a gap off the rest, the other three or four between Liverpool, Chelsea, United, Spurs. I think it's between Arsenal and City, and I think Arsenal could maybe do it this year.
Yeah, I was impressed with Arne Slot. Liverpool in the second half. Jota, Salah, I thought they had lots of shots, loads of chances. I thought they were good, Al.
Yeah, they were brilliant. Yeah, excellent. I agree, Ruby. The first half, Ipswich did what you would expect. The team coming up from, obviously, the Championship and were in Liverpool's faces, pressed them hard, man v man over the pitch, but they just couldn't sustain that. what I liked about Slot, I'm not sure if you saw his interview after the match, Ruby, but...
No, I didn't.
He had an issue, basically, in the first half that he felt was their issue. Not only were they being pressed all over the pitch, excuse me, not only were they being pressed all over the pitch by Ipswich, but he also felt they lost a lot of duels, in aerial duels, because Delap was playing up front for Ipswich and he was a bit of a handful. He did quite well. And Kwanzaa, and he more or less said, not that he threw him under the bus, but he more or less said Kwanzaa lost too many duels, whipped him off at half-time, was ruthless enough to do that in his first match, brought Konate on, and things changed for Liverpool and they were brilliant in the second half and they increased their intensity and the whole thing was different. There was a whole different slant on the match. Arnold was brilliant as well. But I just love that. I think if you're going to manage one of the elite clubs at the elite level, the likes of, we always go back to Klopp, Guardiola, Arteta, you need to be ruthless because the players will drag you down if you're not with them. And if you're not able to stand up for them and make the big, bold decisions and in some cases make them unhappy and in some cases leave them out or even get them out the door, I don't think you'll last. And I thought it was really, really strong from Slot that in the first match, he was willing to make a big call. Now, people will argue, oh, well, Kwanzaa's a young player. He's a young player with big potential and he was involved in the England squad in the Euros as well. So it was a big call at halftime to whip him off and he had no problem doing it. And I love to see that in the manager, Ruby, to go after some of the big boys, make big decisions, big calls. I think it sends out a good message. And in the second half, they were excellent. Salah looked very sharp. So I do think Liverpool, it'll be grand under Slot. Whether I think they'll challenge Man City or Arsenal, I don't think so.
Tell you who else impressed me, Alan, was Aston Villa. They flew out of the traps. The pace they played with, the space they created against West Ham. Look, they were a surprise package last year, but they've hit the ground running again this year.
Yeah, and again, a brilliant manager, Emery. Such a job he's done since he's gone in there, transformed the club. And as you say, Saturday, they picked up right where they left off at the end of last season. The only issue I have for them this year, now he's a specialist at it with some of the, I won't say the lesser clubs, maybe a notch down from the elite clubs. My point being, when he was in Spain, obviously Real Madrid, Barcelona being the elite ones, and he was with Sevilla and Valencia, who were a notch down, but he was able to manage the situation where you're obviously trying to fire on in the league and you're also trying to challenge in Europe. And obviously he was so successful at Europa League level and in winning the trophies that he did with those clubs. Now he's having to manage the Champions League level with Villa and try and maintain a challenge of some sort in the league where you're still in the top six, top four. That's going to be their challenge this year. Whether he can do that, I don't know. Obviously, he has the pedigree to do it at Europa League level. At Champions League level, I think it's going to be a difficult ask. But certainly in terms of the job that he's done and they've picked up right where they left off, really positive result on Saturday. Yeah, he's a brilliant manager.
He most certainly looks so. What about our own team then, Al? They beat Fulham 1-0, Mason Mount, Bruno Fernandes, Garnacho. They all should have scored, like.
Yeah, I watched the Friday night, Ruby, and it was a bit better than what we seen last year. As a start, it was certainly better. It can't be much worse than what we seen last year. I thought the shape of the team looked far better in terms of that they were a lot more compact. And if you think back to the opening night last year, it was actually this night last year, it was a Monday night game against Wolves, and they were being torn to shreds and Wolves were just basically running straight through the middle of them, creating chance after chance. And you're thinking, how is this happening at that level? But yet, that issue was never addressed. And it seemed to happen so often at that level with United time after time last season. So I think that if you look at Mainoo and Casemiro playing as two, sitting in front of the back four, rather than Casemiro as a one isolated on his own, I think that gives the back four a lot more protection and it gives Casemiro protection as well. And they look a lot more solid in that shape. So I think that's a positive. If they can get Mazraoui, who I thought played really well on his debut, if you can get him, De Ligt, Martinez, and whether it's Dalot or Shaw as a left full, if you can get them four on the pitch every week, I think that's a much better I'm far more positive, I suppose, back forward than what we've seen, because the chopping and changing last year made it so difficult for any of them to build relationships as well. And you had Maguire, who was struggling, Johnny Evans coming near the tail end, having to step in a lot of cases. So if you can get them four on the pitch regularly, and a continuous back four that you're picking every week, and there's consistency in that, I think they can have a good season. Up front, I'd still be worried about them. I'm not sure he knows. Does he want to have, I know Hoyland was injured the other night, but does he want to have him as a front nine, or does he want to play with the split forwards like he did the other night with Rashford? And it was Ahmad. I'd still have an issue with Rashford, Ruby. Sour puss on him, new season, you think he'd come back itching to get going, missed a couple of great chances as well, and he has that puss on him moping around the pitch. I hate to see that. Whereas young Garnacho, full of life, full of energy, comes on, makes a difference, and I think he's the future. I'd nearly cash in on Rashford if some of the big clubs were still willing to pay 70 or 80 million, and I'd nearly go with Garnacho, Hoyland, this young lad that scored, Zirchi, and I'd go with young, hungry, positive forwards like that, whereas Rashford is just dragging them down, I think.
Yeah, well, he could be, Alan. I'm not going to doubt you if you think he is. But listen, thanks a million for taking our call. I know you're in Sligo, so go down to town there and tell him what they did wrong. But thanks a million for entertaining us all for half an hour. We have a quick break to take. When we come back, we'll be talking golf with Brian Keogh.
Game on.
Golf.
Welcome back to Game On, and as summer, or whatever kind of summer we had, turns into autumn, lots of seasons are coming to a conclusion, and none more so than golf. Of course, last weekend was the FedEx St. Jude Championship, and I'm delighted to say that Brian Keogh, golf writer of the Irish Independent, joins me on the line. Brian, it's coming to the end of a season, and last weekend, I guess from an Irish point of view, and that's where we'll start, all eyes were on Seamus Power. Could he sneak up the leaderboard enough? And unfortunately, he didn't, but he'd still be happy, will he?
Yeah, I think he will. I mean, it was his first top 10 of the season, Ruby, you know, which kind of says it all, really, about, you know, Seamus's year. I mean, he had that hip injury last year that really, you know, knocked him for six. You know, he missed the back end of the season, you know, didn't qualify for the Ryder Cup, and that put him on the, you know, on the back foot big time, lost, you know, a little bit of speed in his swing as well. That makes a huge difference to a player like Seamus. So it's taken him a while to kind of get up and running this year, you know, and you know, if you just have one top 10 finish, you know, and that was in the first playoff event, it's really hard to make that top 50 who are exempt into all the signature events that they have next year, you know, the 8 signature events plus the players. So he's you know, his card is safe. He's moved up to 56, so he's in the top 70. His card is safe for next year, and he can move up further, you know, over the next while and next year. But, you know, I think he would be pleased with the performance. Yes, 10 under par on that course, surrounded by major champions, was a pretty good effort.
It was a good effort. He moved himself from 67 to 56th, and I'm probably a little bit disappointed with that. But looking at the other Irish players, Rory McIlroy, 68 out of 70 players, disappointing weekend for him.
Yeah, Rory just, you know, he managed to scramble a 200 par round in the first round, birdie in two of the last three holes, I think, but he just wasn't on it off the tee at all week, and really struggled on the greens. You know, he was well down the leaderboard for strokes gained putting, and that was you know, the big thing. Once you end up being so far behind early in a tournament like that, it's very hard to get the shots back, and it was a very tough course as well, you know, despite the scoring, you know, as well. I mean, the winner was 17 under par. It was a tough week for Rory, and you know, the thing is that he just moves down a couple of spots in the FedEx Cup. That doesn't make a huge amount of difference really to where he is going in this week in Denver. So he's down from third to fifth, I think, you know, so not too much damage done, you know, similar to Shane Lowry,
of course. Yeah, he dropped from 10th to 11th. He did finish in a tie for 50th on one under par, but again, with the format ever changing in the FedEx, obviously what happens at the BMW Championship next weekend, the top 30 move on to the Tour Championship to win the FedEx Cup, but the further down you drop, the less shots you have.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, they've rejigged this format over the years. I mean, it did, you know, it was sort of a points race in previous years. I remember one year Vijay Singh, he won so many times that season that all he had to do was just basically stay upright for the four rounds, and he was going to win the FedEx Cup. So they've made a couple of changes to the format over the years. Excuse me. And now they've brought in this sort of staggered start, you know, where the leader of the FedEx Cup point standings after this week's event, you know, we'll start the tournament in Atlanta, the Tour Championship, on 10 under par. The second ranked player will be 8 under par, third ranked 7 under, etc., etc. So it goes down like that. So, you know, Scottie Scheffler was a little bit critical of the whole thing in his press conference for the for the FedEx St. Jude, you know, last week, sort of saying, you know, it's silly calling this a season-long race. It isn't a season-long race. It comes down to, you know, one event at the end and who plays particularly well that week, really. He does have an advantage, but calling it a season-long race is a bit of a stretch. It's not like the old, you know, order of merit or the money list we had in Europe and the United States, where the top money winner was the number one guy and that was it. They're trying to create an entertainment product, as Rory McIlroy said. You know, he said, well, is it fair? Well, you know, maybe not. But it's entertainment, and that's what they're trying to do, become more entertaining. And we all know why they're worried about that.
Yeah, well, it is about entertainment. But you look at someone like Victor Hovland, who went from 57th with a good showing at the weekend. He jumped himself all the way to 16th. So there's two sides of that coin, isn't there?
Yeah, and it is, you know, and I was just rewatching some of it there this morning, you know, and the commentators in Sky were talking about this format is fantastic and this format is great. And, you know, the volatility of it and the way players can move up and down, and player like Hovland, you know, who actually came close to winning the PGA Championship, hasn't had a great year, and can, you know, have a hot week and move into the top 50. You know, it's great entertainment and great to see. And there's great players in the PGA Tour to watch, you know, not all of the great players are on the PGA Tour these days, but they were all there at in Memphis at the weekend.
They were, but I suppose if you're looking at it, and I was kind of looking at it today thinking, is this the competition that misses those guys that are going to live most? Brooks Koepka, John Rahm, Cam Smith, Bryson DeChambeau, to name just a couple. It's when you get into a competition like this where the cream is slowly rising to the top. The golf,
yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely. I mean, you do miss those guys. You know, they were sort of the bad guys or the bad boys that were the entertaining guys, the guys with a little bit of an edge to them. And I think we do miss seeing them. That's why, you know, the majors have been, you know, so entertaining this year. It's the only time we get to see all these players together. And it explains why the PGA Tour is just throwing millions and millions and millions of dollars at these guys just to stop them, you know, being tempted at all by the live money. I mean, they have this thing called the Comcast Tour Top 10, which is basically the top 10 guys at the end of the regular season. They split up 40 million. You know, Shane was 10th. He got 2 million for that. You know, Scottie Scheffler picked up, I can't remember now, I think it was around 8 million, you know. And then, you know, the FedEx Cup playoffs, there's another 100 million at stake there, you know, 25 million for the winner. So it's just crazy money.
Absolute telephone numbers. Victor Hovland, of course, will be happy that he got himself into the top 50. But looking at St. Jude last weekend, when Hideki Matsuyama had a bit of a wobble, did Victor Hovland leave it behind him?
Yeah, well, he had a putt, didn't he, there, you know, at the last. He missed it, you know, and Matsuyama, in fairness to him, he managed to regroup after dropping all those shots in the middle of the back nine, and birdie the 17th, knocked in a long putt. I mean, Matsuyama is a very streaky putter, and when he's on, he's on, but generally it tends to be his Achilles heel. But he travelled with five or six putters, changed putter last week for, you know, to the greens, he thought that would, you know, suit the greens that he was putting on last week. And what does he do? Knocks in a 28-footer on the 17th and then hits a fantastic drive down the last, knocks it into about 6 feet and holds that as well, wins by two. No drama. You know, he's just a world-class player, isn't he? You know, a Masters champion, and those guys can do that kind of thing. So it was great to see him, you know, not throw it away, having played so brilliantly for the entire week to put himself in the position he was in. And and great to see Hovland showing a little bit of form again.
Yeah, it was good to see. Obviously, Matsuyama started Sunday morning with a 5-shot lead, but it was an incident on the 7th where he stood on a pitch mark on the 7th green. Was it an incident? Was the referee being overly, I don't know.
They were just making sure that... Yeah, I mean, you know, you're not allowed, you know, obviously if you're on the green and your ball is on the green, you're allowed, you know, repair your pitch park. But if you're not on the green and it could be in the line of your next shot and you could be, you know, deemed to have improved, you know, your line of play, then that would be a 2-stroke penalty. But pitch park was nowhere near where Matsuyama was going to pitch the ball. The replay showed that he didn't pitch it. It was close enough, but it was nowhere near where he was trying to hit it. And the officials were just trying to hear his point of view and the thing. And we move on. There was nothing to see here. He didn't gain any advantage. And I think it probably upset him a little bit, perhaps lost a little bit of focus after that. And that's when he, you know, started to drop those shots. But he managed to regroup like the major champion he is and go on and win.
He most certainly did. A couple of big names that are missing, of course, from the BMW Championship next weekend will be Justin Rose. Ricky Fowler never even got in to be there. And the other big name that's gone is Jordan Spieth. And he's going for surgery, I think, is he?
Yeah, Jordan Spieth, yeah, he's had a wrist problem that he just really needs to get sorted out. You know, I think he's probably going to miss out on the President's Cup, perhaps, if he gets that looked after and, try and come back next year. Obviously, you know, Ryder Cup in Betpage will be a big thing for him as well. So just best to get these things sorted out. But yeah, the FedEx Cup, it's a relentless beast, and as we saw with some players, you can have a hot week like Hovland and move up, or you can have a poor week and just get knocked out. So it's important as well, for players, especially the European players looking to make that Ryder Cup team next year. I mean, there's extra points for anybody playing in those signature events. They're going to have huge points for Luke Donald's team next year. So that's very big, for people like Robert McIntyre, who's moved well up the standard. Now I think he's up to 12th, it's good for him, good for Victor Hovland as well, obviously, Mathieu Pavon, even Aaron Rye, the English guy, who won his first tournament there last week, so it's important to be in that top 50. You get into all those big signature events next year, because it means you're going to have a chance to make more Ryder Cup points.
And Ryder Cup points are very, very important. The DP World Tour is in full flow as well. It was the Czech Masters at the weekend in Prague even, and a maiden victory for David Ravetto.
Yeah, French guy, yeah.
64, incredible.
Absolutely, yeah. No, wonderful, wonderful victory for him, a life-changing result for him as well. He's a Q school graduate, I think, and he beat Jesper Svensson, the Swede, has been really impressive this year. He's up to third now in the race to Dubai. He's going to be on the PGA Tour next year as one of those 10 cards that they offer to the leading 10 not already exempt on the European Tour. So yeah, it's a great stepping stone, the European Tour to the PGA Tour these days. And the French really producing some great talent, as are the Swedes. I mean, I think they won the boys and the girls amateur championships at the weekend as well, and the French had three in the top five. So they're certainly doing a lot of good things in French golf at the moment.
A couple of our own golfers did okay at the weekend on the Challenge Tour. That was in Finland, of course. Danny Mulligan and Conor O'Rourke, who's actually from Nace, did okay. And Mark Power, who had a 64 in the first round, he fell away a bit, but they're doing their best, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a big week, for Mark to try and move up the rankings a little bit. He wants to make sure he's sort of in the top 125 or even the top 90, really, is where you want to be, just to make sure of your card for next year. He's been playing on a sort of a conditional status this year. You don't get very many starts, and you really got to take advantage of them when you do get them, So, Mark would be disappointed probably not to have, pushed on more, but you can just get caught in a cavalry charge on that Challenge Tour these days. I mean, we're at 272s at the weekend. That's just going backwards in Challenge Tour golf. You don't just have the young guys, the young Turks from all these federations all over Europe and all over the world now, but you've also got the guys, the very experienced players, who've dropped down from the DP World Tour, veterans, 40-year-old guys who maybe won tournaments and, are hungry to get back there again, So, Mark moves up, he moves up 7 places to 110th. So, that'll give him a little bit of a boost, and he'll be going to Q school later in the year looking for better. But also a great result for Daniel Mulligan as well, from Mornington, there near Drogheda. He turned pro when he was 16. He's only 19 years of age. So, he's getting out there and doing it in the pro game rather than sticking around in the amateur ranks to see what he can do. And then Conor O'Rourke is a guy who's been around for a while. He's 33 now, and he's just looking for that one big week, really. That's what all those guys are looking for, to get off that Challenge Tour, get in the top 20 and try and get on the DP World Tour, which is where it's at these days. So the Challenge Tour, it's a hard school if you're there for any more than 4 or 5 years, really. It's very difficult to get off. So it's all about really trying to get a win, and the competition is ferocious.
It is ferocious. Does obviously Mark won his way, or played his way into the Amgen Irish Open at Royal County Down on the 11th of September. Does a competition like that, a good finish there, give him more chance of getting to where he wants to get rather than having to grind it out on the Challenge Tour?
Yeah, it can do. Yeah, you can win enough money to get some sort of a ranking on the DP World Tour and get a leg up. I mean, Rory McIlroy, I think he won his European Tour card in four or five starts on the DP World Tour at the you know, the start of his career in 2007. You know, he had a couple of top tens, and all of a sudden he was you know, inside the top whatever it was at the time, 110, and he was on the tour. You know, but Shane Lowry won an Irish Open as an amateur. I mean, these guys are outstanding players, and that's just not what happens usually. You know, but certainly you see some of the you know, top college players in America. They come through that PGA Tour U system, and there is a similar system now starting in Europe as well, through the World Amateur Golf Ranking, which will give guys a bit more of a leg up earlier in their careers, and a way of getting onto the Challenge Tour and onto the European Tour. So it doesn't always have to be heading off to America to try and make your way. You can also do it in Europe, playing amateur golf in Europe as well.
Well, there's no easy way to get to the top. Are you looking forward to the Irish Open, Ryle County Down? Great venue for it.
I think I'm hoping for a bit of an Indian summer. You know, we didn't have very good weather there the last time the Irish Open was there, and the weather was pretty miserable. But you know, it's just such a magnificent setting for a golf course. It really is one of the great links you know, in the world, one of the greatest courses in the world, really. And you know, hopefully we'll have a good field. Obviously McIlroy and Lowry and Patrick Harrington and all those guys will be back, and Seamus Power as well, who really is a top player. I mean, I don't think people realize, you know, if you look at where Seamus Power was at the weekend and the company he's keeping, and what he's done on the PGA Tour over the last few years, winning twice, it's just been really tremendous. You know, he's a fantastic player. So, I mean, there's going to be plenty of talent to watch, and a few young Irish guys as well. So we'll be looking forward to it very much so.
I think we all will. Brian, thank you so much for taking our call this evening. We have a quick break to take, but when we come back, we'll be looking at the Vuelta a España.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. So the Vuelta a España started last Saturday. It actually started in Portugal, with the first stage kicking off in Lisbon. And today was the third and final stage in Portugal. It went from Lusa to Castelo Branco. Shane Stokes joins us on the line. Shane, Wout van Aert, the Belgian, is leading after three stages. How's it been?
Yeah, it's been very interesting. Wout van Aert crashed earlier this year, so he hasn't had a win in 6 months. He went into the race really desperately trying for a win after two runner-up slots in the Tour de France on stages. So he was third in the opening time trial, second yesterday, and then he won today. So this was the sequence pointed towards a win. But he was quite clever, because he launched the sprint early and slightly hemmed in the rider, Caden Groves, who was second against the barriers. So Caden Groves, he did it completely legally. You're not allowed to do something very obvious. So it was just a very slight hemming in. So Caden Groves had to go the long way around and ended up half a bike length short. So, yes, so it ended a six-month drought of wins, and it consolidated his overall lead in the race.
Tactical gamesmanship, you can't knock anybody for that. We've two Irish riders, of course, Eddie Dunbar and Darren Rafferty. Neither contested today's sprint, rolling in 35th and 55th. But how have they been going the first 3 days?
Yeah, they've been. The goal is really to stay out of trouble. So Eddie Dunbar is a general classification rider. He was seventh in last year's Giro d'Italia. He was actually sitting fourth overall with 3 days to go, and then got sick, so slipped to seventh. And since then, he crashed out of last year's Vuelta and this year's Giro, so he's really hoping for better luck in this year's Vuelta now. So his aim is to sharpen his form in this opening week. But he's sitting 30th overall, and that's solid, because he wouldn't be a time trialist. And I suppose tomorrow is the first summer's finish, and the goal is to fare as well as possible there. Darren Rafferty is a first year professional. He's really talented. He's riding his first Grand Tour, and he's sitting 33rd overall, so just 1 second behind Dunbar. He's primarily in the race to ride for Richard Carapaz, the team leader, but it's also about building experience for the years ahead. But he's got the kind of class that he could potentially go for a stage win later in the race.
I was reading a quote from Wout van Aert there this evening. He doesn't expect to be wearing the red jersey tomorrow afternoon. He reckons it'll slip away from him as the GC riders come to the fore. What name should we be looking out for?
I think Primoz Roglic normally would be the rider to look out for. He won three previous editions of the Vuelta, but he did crash in the Tour, and he did suffer a back fracture. But he's known as a very tough competitor who has returned from some big crashes before to win the Vuelta. So he's probably the big name. Sepp Kuss is the defending champion from last year. So he's also a very good climber. So he's another rider who could fare well. And Joao Almeida, a Portuguese rider, actually, he's part of a very strong UAE Emirates team, as is Adam Yates, and they would also be amongst the guys to look out for. So, yeah, it's going to be very interesting. It's a very, very steep final climb. There's about 3 kilometres over 10% in gradient, and it's going to be just a day that really upends the general classification and points towards the guys who... will be challenging for the final overall victory in the race.
Well, the resilience, determination and fitness of a Grand Tour rider is something that has always fascinated me, and I'm delighted to say that Dan Martin joins us on the line as well. Dan, the 2020 Vuelta a España was definitely a highlight for you. You were third in the first two stages before winning the third stage. Was a good start in 2020 key to you finishing fourth overall that year?
Obviously, I'd come out of the Tour de France. It was a bit of a strange year that year because it was a COVID year and the season was all rearranged. So, yeah, I mean, when you start a Grand Tour well, it always just gives your whole team a boost and yourself a boost, and you can just carry that momentum as far as you can. You know, it's a lot easier than chasing your tail when you've, cause obviously mentally, it's a big mental game, this the Grand Tour racing, because it's just obviously you're battling fatigue each day. And If you're not in the game from the start, it is really hard to get your head back into the game. And so yeah, obviously a lot of the GC guys will be looking to start well tomorrow. Some of them had a bad day on the first day. Everybody always comes out of those TTs on the first stage when you've lost time and says, "Oh, it's insignificant, it's not worth it." But it is a bit of a mental blow, and it is hard to refine your feet. So the guys who lost a little bit more time will be looking to capitalize on the harder terrain tomorrow. And I looked at their profile, and it's a hard climb. It's a different type of climb to what the guys would have been prepared for later in the race. There's about 3 kilometres of 12, 13, even 15, as a kilometre, even 15%, with about 3 kilometres to go. So, and the last 2 kilometres is a bit easier, but it's short, steep climb, very hot conditions, and that's what makes the Vuelta special as well. Obviously, 2020, we had a lot cooler conditions. I think, obviously, the race was in late October, November, so it was very different to what the riders will be enduring the next few days.
Well, it was a climb like tomorrow's, 15% for over a kilometre. Was that the kind of challenge you loved?
Yeah, tomorrow would have been a great stage for me, to be honest. It's one of those stages that I still look at now and think, that's the one I wish I'll be lining up. I mean, it kind of drags into 5K to go, and then between 5K to go and 2K to go, there's a real steep section between 12 and 15%. And then it flattens off again towards the finish, 6, 7%. So it's going to be a real sorting out. It's a test that we'll really see who has got the legs to go well in this Vuelta a España. Because the Vuelta, more than any of the other Grand Tours, you see the guys early on in the race that will be there in the GC battle in the end. Because there's 7 mountaintop finishes in this race, and there's another 2 really hard mountain stages along with that. So it's there is time to recoup your losses if you lose time early on, but the way the Vuelta is written slightly differently, in that it's kind of, you really, because it's the end of the year, the guys who start well are generally the guys who are really up for it, and they're not going to ride into condition because it's been a long season already of racing and there's fatigue in the body. And the guys who are going well now, they generally, it's a race to hold on. They're not building condition anymore.
I'd say they're not. Also, what fascinates me about it, you look at the profile of the Vuelta, and you look at the transfers from some of the starts to the finishes. Like, you cycle all day, then they pack you into a bus. Like, even getting from one place to the next must be hard on your body.
It's long days. I mean, that's what it's hard to understand how long the days are, especially now with the, like, teams like to arrive 2 hours before at least the start. So, yeah, say you've got to start at midday. Like, you're leaving the hotel at 9 o'clock at the latest most days, and some days you're not getting back to the hotel till 7:30, 8 o'clock at night. Some days even later. So, yeah, it's long days on the road, and mentally that takes a toll, obviously, and recovery as well. I mean, that's why you see a lot of the teams now, it's a battle to get their core temperatures lower, especially in these extreme heat they're going to be seeing in southern Spain. They've got ice baths set up at the finish to try, and because your body doesn't start recovering until you've got your core temperature back to normal. So that's why you'll see a lot of the guys just sitting in ice baths, getting their body into recovery mode before they've even started the transfer. Whereas obviously back in when I was racing, it was a case of get to the hotel, then try and figure that stuff out.
What about food, nutrition, etc.? Into the ice bath, eat while you're at it, like, or the logistics of it is just incredible.
Yeah, it's really, there's obviously full kitchens and full, well, not full kitchens, but they've got a full setup in there, ready to go when they finish the stage. The guys, they've got recovery drinks, rice, pasta, right? Generally, yeah, fish, chicken, as soon as the race is finished almost, you know, and it's just a battle to get as many calories into yourself as possible. But obviously hydration is the most important thing when these can, when the weather's disheartened. It's getting all those salts back into you as fast as possible. But I think the in-race nutrition is so good now. The bigger emphasis is on that core temperature, and so the guys aren't. It's not like they're finishing the race starving hungry. You know, they're really. It's about getting the right things into you, the nutrients into you, and then concentrating on the carb loading later that night.
Oh, the excitement of it! Kill yourself up the side of a mountain at 15 degrees to jump into an ice bath. Incredible people. Simple as that.
Dan Martin,
thank you. I don't know about that. Dan Martin, thank you so much for taking our call. We've run out of time, I'm afraid, this evening. I could talk all night about what the cyclists are going to have to do between now and getting themselves to Madrid in about a little over 2 weeks' time. But the Vuelta a España does kick off tomorrow from Plasencia. We run out of time this evening. Thanks to Dan Martin and Shane Stokes for talking to us, as well as Brian Keogh and Alan Colley. Ronan Lawler was your producer. I was Ruby Walsh. I'll be back tomorrow. The music show is up next. 2FM.